Hello and welcome to Pro Money Talk. I'm Jason, and I'm also standing in for Peter this week. Peter is at the Financial Planning Association conference in Tennessee. This week's interview, however, was done by Peter. It is an interview with Duncan Glassy. Duncan is the author of a book called Financial Freedom Using the Wealth Flow System. It was published in January 2005. He specializes in investment consultancy and a holistic personal financial planning. He has a particular emphasis on what we call life planning. Now, Peter and Duncan will talk about that a little bit more in the interview, but essentially what life planning is and what holistic planning means is working with a client and looking at every aspect of their financial life and making sure that that works together with their life goals, what they're trying to accomplish in their lives. For some, that might be early retirement. For some, that might be leaving a lot of money to charity or children. Whatever that is, tailoring the financial planning process to fit that. And that includes investing, that includes taxation, that includes estate planning, that includes insurance. And so really looking at all these things and making sure they work together. Now, before we get into that, I want to remind everyone that the College Success Guide that Peter wrote is available on the website. It was available as a download on our last show. We got quite a few people who downloaded it and love to get any feedback, comments, or suggestions about what you thought. Of course, you can visit our website at promoneytalk.com to get information on this show and on past shows and to listen to past shows. There you can also sign up for our mailing list. If you're on the mailing list, you'll get alerts for every new show that comes out and from time to time, special offers that we might have for our listeners only. Of course, we won't spam you or sell our mailing list. If you have any comments or questions, you can also write to us, go on the website and you can send us an email and we'll answer them. Or better yet, you can give us a call. The phone number to call with questions is area code 206-250-3428. If you want to listen to Pro Money Talk on your cell phone, you can do that now. We have a button on our website that says mobilize the latest episode. And if you click on that button, you'll be able to type in your cell phone number and whatever episode you are trying to listen to will be sent to your cell phone and you can listen to it on the cell phone. It's pretty cool. Peter's interview with Duncan was done on a new piece of equipment that we just got. It's for those audio geeks out there, it's called a Telos One, and it's a piece of audio equipment that allows us to do interviews over the phone. And, you know, I don't know how it works, but it provides for really good voice quality. It's a piece of equipment that the PBS stations use for their interviews. And so it's really a step up for us in this process. And I think you'll notice that it sounds pretty good. It sounds as good as a phone interview can be, I think. And the reason, of course, that we had to do a phone interview with Duncan is that Duncan lives in Scotland. And I say, of course, because you'll figure that out as soon as you start listening to the interview. He's got a really cool accent. Peter wanted me to mention that if you have trouble with foreign accents, don't worry, we'll have subtitles on the show. You just have to look really hard. One thing that we've noticed from our listener feedback is that a lot of our listeners come from foreign countries. We've had people write in from Germany. We've had people from Canada, Japan, various other Western European countries, quite a few from England and the UK. And of course, we have quite a few financial planners, accountants, and other professionals who listen to the show as well. And so we thought that this show might be particularly appealing to those in foreign countries. Duncan is a financial planner, but also I think it should be appealing to the bulk of our listeners in America as well. Because the questions that Peter asks and the topics that they cover really focus on the personal aspect of planning, and that's universal. Now, Duncan is a strong believer in fee-only planning. Fee-only planning, of course, refers to planners who do not work on a commission, but planners who are compensated solely by the fees that they charge to their clients. The idea behind fee-only planning is that it reduces the number of conflicts of interest. So in other words, if you're earning a commission, there might be the perception that advice that you give on certain products is driven by your compensation. However, when you're getting a fee and it's only coming from the client, you reduce that conflict. There is no conflict there because any advice that you give, you do not get compensated any differently for. And Duncan's a big believer in that, but he's one of the few in the UK who practices that way. In fact, even in the United States, there aren't a whole lot of planners who practice in that manner. Duncan is based in Edinburgh, Scotland. Duncan is the Planned Savings Magazine's Financial Planner of the Year 2000. He won in the category Investment and Investment Planning. He serves on the Scottish Branch Committee of the Institute of Financial Planning. Duncan's an associate of the Institute of Financial Planning, a member of the Personal Finance Society, a pension transfer specialist, an accredited mediator, and is one of the few Scots to hold the internationally recognized Certified Financial Planner license. That's the CFP. In the spirit of full disclosure here, I have to mention that Duncan's book, Financial Freedom Using the Wealth Flow System, was published by Advisor Press. Peter and I are on the board of Advisor Press. All bias aside, I do think that it's a fantastic book. So without further ado, I hope you will enjoy this show, Financial Planning, The View from Scotland.
In this episode of Pro Money Talk, we're going to bring some international perspective to the practice of financial planning. We're going to talk about some of the financial challenges that all of us, simply because we're human beings, face, as well as getting a glimpse of how those needs are addressed differently by financial advisors in Great Britain versus the United States. We'll also talk about specific tools and techniques that individuals and families can use to get the most out of the financial planning process and bring their finances into alignment with their personal goals and values. Our guest today is Duncan Glassie, a certified financial planner based in Edinburgh, Scotland. Duncan has 16 years of experience in financial services and is the author of a book called Financial Freedom Using the Wealth Flow System. Duncan, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and why you've chosen to take a different path in providing financial services to people?
Well, that's a good question, Peter. You mentioned 16 years, and I think like many people who are perhaps listening who have a financial services background, they'll have witnessed and experienced, you know, a lot of good and bad practices over a period of time. Particularly over 16 years, and I'm sure it's the same in the US as it is in the UK or Australia. I think the financial planning profession is simply an evolving profession. My views in many ways or my experiences have evolved with a lot of help from financial planners in the States. I've looked closely at what works, what various certified financial planners do well in the States, and attempted to replicate the services that are offered to clients in the UK and move away perhaps from the heavy product orientation or heavy sales orientation that still exists in the UK, as I'm sure it probably still does all over the world. It's about getting a little bit closer to the clients. It's about understanding their needs. And ultimately, it perhaps means dealing with a smaller number of clients rather than the many thousands of clients that perhaps financial advisors have dealt with in the past.
So there's a tendency in the industry to sell products, earn commissions, and find the next sale as quickly as possible. And certainly that hasn't been a perfect model for the consumer, but consumers also have some predispositions or weaknesses that lead them into the wrong types of services as well. Maybe you could say something about that.
Yes, I mean, I think although the financial planning profession is now learning from some of the past mistakes, I think it's all too easy for consumers perhaps to want action. They perhaps want to be titillated. They want to think that someone out there has information that they don't have, information that may make them a quick profit. And I think when it comes to investment advice, this has been the myth that has been passed off for decades as investment advice. That there is still perhaps the dangerous view that if you were to pay someone $300 or $400 per hour to a particular financial advisor, let's say, that they will give an accurate prediction of the future, you know, of future stock market movements, whether that be up or down. And I think that's particularly dangerous and something that we, or something that I'm very keen not to put forward as a strength of the practice. We ultimately believe that there is efficiencies in markets, particularly in global stock markets, and that none of us, and I certainly don't believe I have the ability to look into the future and see what's ahead.
I think the weight of the evidence is behind that view, that despite the fact that every day on the financial news networks we hear experts pontificating on which way the market's going tomorrow and so on, that in reality there's a lot of smart people out there. Prices may not reflect the actual value of investments on any given day, but given the fact that there are millions of investors and many of them are very smart, it's really kind of a loser's game to try to outguess them on a consistent basis.
Yeah, most definitely. And I think even just to go back a step, I think that the difficulty that consumers have is that the marketplace, certainly in the UK, has almost, it's used far too much jargon. I think sometimes intentionally it has attempted to confuse the investor. It doesn't help to educate the investor. And then the press as well, perhaps, can be guilty of promoting particular investment themes that it perhaps isn't qualified to give that type of advice, but it doesn't stop it from doing so. I think in many ways what I've learned over the last 3 years has been that the psychology of money is very, very dangerous. In fact, I'd go as far as to say it's the reason why clients don't stay the course, and perhaps in a way they sabotage their own future. They're often looking for the next big thing, and some financial advisors, some financial planners perhaps don't help in trying to promote something that's supposedly going to take off. And so it's I think, a myriad of conflicting messages that make it very, very difficult for the consumer at the end of the day.
So the media and the financial services industry, in a way, plays into the unhealthy tendencies of people who really don't have perspective on how this whole thing works. There's some interesting studies that you've quoted about the average performance of investors versus the markets.
Yes, I'm very aware of some of the research that's been conducted. I have to say, most of the research that I have come across has been in the US. In the UK, we still, I think we lack a lot of the academic research. It doesn't certainly come through in the press if it is being done in the UK. And I don't know if that's because of the pressures of, you know, effectively a multi-billion pound financial services industry that perhaps doesn't always want people to know some of the academic findings. I do remember some years ago reading about Peter Lynch, the famous manager of the Magellan Fund, Fidelity's flagship fund. And I remember reading that when he retired, although he accepted he had done very, very well as a mutual fund manager, one of his biggest regrets was that when he analyzed the inflows and outflows of money for the average investor, he found that the likelihood was that rather than the investors benefiting from the average return that had been achieved over the whole investment period, which I think was somewhere in the region of 15 years, and the return was somewhere in the region of 14% compound per annum, that the average investor had actually made a loss. And that really was because the fund was being talked up when the fund was doing well, perhaps because of market cycles, not perhaps because of the fund manager. And then when it was doing poorly, again, a natural cycle perhaps, advisors and stockbrokers were advising clients to get out. So people were buying at the wrong time, getting out at the wrong time, and ultimately, as you mentioned earlier, you know, they were becoming losers in the whole event.
Which is amazing. I hope that our listeners have heard the meaning of what you're talking about here. While the market returned double-digit returns, the average investor had losses or very small returns, because they were trying to outguess the market. And that's over a very large number of people, over a very long period of time, or a significant period of time. So that's significant. And We have a group over here in the U.S. called the Luthold Group in Minneapolis, which does a fantastic job of original research on a number of areas. And they have a monthly chart that shows the sales of mutual funds, and it shows it in conjunction with where the market is. And whenever the market goes down, people are net sellers of mutual fund shares, and when it goes up, they're net buyers. So people react, sort of human nature, to look backwards at what's just happened and expect it to continue. And perhaps it is being talked up, or their friends are telling them, you have to get into this. So really, they don't have the perspective, and they're making sort of blind calls based on emotions because they don't have anything else to go on. One of the questions I wanted to ask you today was, do you think everybody could benefit from working with a financial planner? Or do you think some people are fine handling their finances on their own?
I think that's a very interesting question. I think if, as consumers, if we could just get the basics right, if we could have a belief system that we could stick by, then I think we could probably do a pretty good job on our own. What I help clients with is to help them to diversify their investment base, to ignore the press, to ignore the TV shows, and basically just accept that no one out there, however much you want to pay them, has the ultimate answer. No one knows what's going to happen in the future. But by doing some basic and smart things, by diversifying, by looking to hold investments across what I would refer to as different asset classes, but basically it means holding equities that are in the US, but also internationally in the UK and in continental Europe, perhaps holding corporate debt and government debt, perhaps even holding commercial property or residential property in the US through a mutual type fund. And really, the old adage of putting your eggs in different baskets. And I think that would be a big step forward. Too often, if I'm asked to go and speak at an investment conference for private investors, I cringe at the end when perhaps there's a forum where the speakers are asked to name the next hot fund. And I think that there is a mentality within the investment world that, or the investment industry, that the consumers ultimately want something sexy, something that they can jump on board and make a phenomenal return from. And fundamentally, I think if we can avoid that as consumers and investors, we're on the first rung to a much healthier financial future.
I couldn't agree more. But I can just imagine some people who are listening to this thinking, if you don't know the next thing that's going to do well, how do you make money?
Well, I think that's the whole point. And no one does know what's going to do well in the future. So at the end of the day, if you simplify it, most people would agree that over the long term, investing in the economy is going to outperform cash. And I think at the end of the day, that's all we're trying to do. We're all trying to outperform cash so that our money will keep ahead of inflation, so that when we need to draw upon that capital, perhaps in retirement or perhaps just at a later date, then the money has kept pace and has a real value. And I think if we perhaps just remember that, it makes life a little bit easier. And there's therefore not the expectation on ourselves to be getting these double-digit returns year on year. If I could just add, Peter, to that as well, as well as diversification, which someone could do in a very simple way, just by buying a range of mutual funds in different asset classes in different geographical locations, or investing in different geographical locations, but also to look to buy those underlying funds as cheaply or as cost-effectively as possible. In the UK, I think we're a little bit behind the curve in the fact that what we call unit trusts and investment trusts, or you would call mutual funds, they're very, very expensive in the UK. And what we do as financial planners is attempt to buy those funds at institutional prices. And what I mean by that is there's no upfront bid offer spread, and the annual management charges are significantly reduced. Now, my impression is that in the US, you perhaps don't have an expensive fund management industry. I may be wrong on that front. But diversifying, buying the assets at a reasonable price, not paying an expensive price, not paying heavy charges is what I mean by that. And then finally, the third part would be simply to write out a date in your diary where each year you would go back to your portfolio and you would rebalance. You would, what I mean by that is you would look at the assets that had done better than expected, let's say, or who had moved out with their original asset allocation of the appointment of funds to different asset classes, and you would rebalance. You would sell the assets that had done well, and you would buy the assets that had done poorly. And I think that is the most difficult thing for a private investor, because it is so counterintuitive, you know, to sell something that's doing well and buy something that's doing badly. Mm. We just don't want to do that. And what then happens is the thing that was doing well falls back, and the thing that's doing badly, we hold on thinking it will come good, and it doesn't come good. It can be disastrous. So discipline is an important factor.
And the discipline is based on the idea that over longer periods, all of the asset classes will give you market-based returns simply by their nature. So that even if something has lagged for a little while, eventually it will catch up. But I think people confuse a mutual fund with an individual stock, where if an individual stock is going down, it may not come back. But a mutual fund, diversified, you're invested in the economy, as you say.
Yes, that's, again, an important point to make. Within my own practice, within my own way of working, I would not encourage clients in the UK, or my clients or any clients, to invest in direct equities or individual stocks, as you would say. I do not believe that that is, I think it's fundamentally flawed because it fails to diversify, and very few private investors have the wealth to buy sufficient quantities of individual equities or individual stocks to diversify away the risk. So in the UK, you'll find a movement towards mutual-type funds and a movement away from individual stocks. Stockbrokers perhaps will still go down that road, but financial planners would be nervous of gambling by choosing individual shareholdings.
I think that's pretty true here in the United States as well, that when I see clients come in who've been with stockbrokers, they have a handful of individual stocks. And in one case this week, I saw someone who all they had was oil stocks. And I thought, well, that's not very diversified, whereas we tend to use mutual funds. We're not trying to sell a hot story. We're just trying to get people to participate so that they can get those benefits of being in the markets over the longer period. So we're not doing anything very sexy. I don't know how we're going to sell our services. But I think people actually who've been through that other approach realize that it hasn't worked out very well. It's been a lot of ups and downs, and the results have not been as good.
Yeah. I think the point you make is a very solid one. I think that anything that's sexy is probably bad news. It would be perhaps nice to work in a very sexy profession, but in actual fact, I think if we're going to do the right thing by our clients, we have to keep them away from the sexy products. I think that's part of our job, part of our responsibility as financial planners.
But the real excitement for, I think, you and me, because we've talked before, is getting to know the clients and what is important to them, and helping them feel comfortable, helping them stick with a discipline and enjoy the fruits of it. That is exciting.
Most definitely. I think it's just having the time to listen to clients. I know as I was growing as a financial planner, and I look back to the environments that I was perhaps involved in, where I was expected to give snippets of information or advice to many, many clients, one after the other, I was unable to really build any form of rapport. And I think that is sadly all too often the case. And giving one-off pieces of advice to complex situations that you cannot truly understand in short meetings, where you may see a client once a year, I personally think that model is doomed to failure. So effectively, what I've created in Edinburgh is a practice whereby I will look after no more than 40 families. It allows me to meet with them quarterly. It allows me to really understand what their plans are for the future, what their hopes are for the future, and to really travel with them and help them understand more about what the markets are about and to avoid the mistakes. But it sadly requires time, and not every financial planning business model allows that time.
And not every investor or person who needs to do financial planning can afford to buy that kind of time. But a good place to start is just a little self-education, and then hopefully building up to that, finding somebody to bounce ideas off of, because this, there, in many ways what we're talking about is simple, but in the whole realm of financial planning, there's a lot going on and it changes all the time. So I find that when I sit down with clients, every time, almost without fail, during our conversation, I learn something new about them, and it opens up a new opportunity for us to do something that maybe they hadn't thought about and I hadn't thought about. So the more time we spend together sort of talking and exploring without pressure, without an agenda, the better off they are. It's sort of the consistent small steps that add up to something over time.
Most definitely. Yeah, it's just all about listening. And I think the point you make about acknowledging that there'll be things, you know, that financial planners won't always have all the answers. And by listening and understanding the client, then things will naturally unfold and naturally come out and then can be prioritized. And what perhaps initially felt like the most important thing or a burning question that required it to be addressed or issue that required to be addressed, perhaps wasn't, after all, that important.
Well, that brings me to the whole concept of life planning, as it's known in our industry, and your approach, which is client-based. What kinds of questions do you ask clients to elicit some of their deeper goals and feelings that they may not even be aware of?
For some clients, we might just open up with a question about, you know, what is important about money to you? And from that, I may not speak then for another hour, because the client might be busy talking and explaining really what it's all about and what it means to them. Question's important. I wouldn't say there was a fixed format. I think that would depersonalize the service in many ways. But when I wrote Financial Freedom using the Wealthflow system, that was an attempt to create a framework that people could work through. And it is very question orientated. And what I've tried to do is ask questions that don't. It's not a book that tells people necessarily how to manage their money or how to budget, but it asks, I hope, pointed questions that makes them think, am I actually doing the smartest things with my money? So it's almost a book to help people travel their own journey, but with some pointers and some road signs along the way.
That's why I brought up the question of questions, because in your book you have some very intriguing questions that point people towards a deeper reflection, because we tend to fall into sort of rote questions that we've heard elsewhere, or rote answers that we've heard elsewhere, or things we think we're supposed to do, but they may not be consistent with the lives that we really want to live, or our values.
Chapter 1, Peter, is all about allowing the reader to understand themselves, and that is done simply by asking questions. So there's 100 questions in Chapter 1. There's no right or wrong answers, just really for the reader to get a feel for, you know, what they want from their lives and what they want from money and the relationship they have with money, perhaps, as well. It may be one large question. It may be, what's the most important thing about money to you? You know, if you actually were just to sit down and say, what is the most important thing about money to me or for me? And just to analyze that, I think lots of wonderful things will come out. And there are other questions, and I won't go through all of them. I said there's 100 in Chapter 1, but there are probably 7 key ones that I've used personally with myself and had some great results from it. And that is, what 5 things do you value most in life? And actually just having a bit of inner reflection and just trying to understand who is important, what's important in our life. And perhaps just giving yourself some time to throw out some answers. Again, I would treat all of this as a little bit of fun. And also perhaps to say, on the first attempt, it may be very, very difficult to answer some of these questions, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's perhaps to be expected. The second question, what are your 3 most important goals in life right now? And from this, thinking about what your 3 most important goals are will probably bring a sense of what's worrying you at the moment as well as what's inspiring you at the moment. So different answers from that. A little bit more thought-provoking might be, how would you spend your time differently if you were told you only have 6 months to live? And I know people perhaps have read through popular psychology these types of questions, but I think we should underestimate the power of them.
Mm-hmm.
So how would you spend your time differently if you only had 6 months to live? And perhaps giving yourself just a small amount of time to throw something down. What happens if you were to win $20 million on the national lottery? you know, what impact would that have? Would you change your life? And having been involved, actually, in advising lottery winners over the years, it is often surprising how little people actually change. And that again, is quite an eye-opener. The last three would be, what have you always wanted to do in life but been afraid to attempt? And again, very soul-searching. What situations in the past have given you the greatest feeling of importance? Again, I think a tremendous question for just helping us to follow the paths that we should be following, perhaps. And then lastly, what one great thing would you perhaps dare to dream if you knew you couldn't fail? And again, these are old questions, perhaps, but if you've come across them for the first time, I think they can be very, very powerful. And I've certainly asked myself these questions over the last 20 years, and it's given me some great direction.
Those are fantastic questions. And I think that we have to challenge ourselves to look at our lives anew continuously and to experience things as best we can from our current perspective if we want to get the most out of the process. And I also wanted to say that I think the tone of your book is playful and insightful enough that it sort of sets the mood for people to be in the flow and to be ready to answer these kinds of questions. So I think you've done a really good job of creating an environment for reflection for your readers.
Oh, thank you, Peter.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, to some extent you're saying that money is important, but to get the most benefit out of it, it really needs to be viewed in the larger context of what makes a person happy.
Yes, and I think from my own perspective, it's not for me to say, you know, or to judge what makes someone happy. Someone will. Mm-hmm. For me, it's to uncover what that factor is, and then to help them build around that.
I really liked what you said in the book about success. You said, success, I believe, is composed of four ingredients: health and energy, loving relationships, meaningful work, and financial independence. I think if you don't have that money piece, then you have a lot of problems in the other areas eventually. So money can be a tool to help you achieve those other things, but you listed money and financial independence as really the fourth thing, not the first.
Yes, and I think for many of us, it's we want to have sufficient money that we don't have to worry about money. But that is, you know, having sufficient money is a long way from the consumer world that we live in. We are often brainwashed into thinking that we have to live a certain lifestyle, have a certain car or a certain home. And I think, again, part of the psychology of money is breaking away from that. If you can control your expenditure, which, if I could just say to the listeners, it's something that I appreciate, that financial services is complex and there is an awful lot of jargon. But if you simplify everything down, we're really talking about three variables, and that is how much income you earn, what your assets or your investments are returning, and the third one is your expenditure. And for many, many people, the only one they truly, truly have control over is their expenditure. For many people, they cannot go to their boss and say, I want 50% more this year. They cannot go to a financial advisor or financial planner and say, I want 50% returns on my assets this year. But what they can do is they can seriously look at where the money's going, what they're spending it on, and looking at that. And for many of my clients, I accept that many of the clients are very wealthy, but it doesn't mean that they're not concerned about how they spend their money.
Someone once pointed out that a dollar saved is $2 earned, because you actually pay taxes on what you have to earn. So it's a very powerful technique to look at saving money, and it can be a very freeing technique, although it may seem somewhat limiting at first glance. I think it's safe to say that the more you focus on your finances and what you're doing and your results, the better the results will be. And a financial planner maybe can facilitate that process, make it a little more effective, kind of like having a teacher or a coach or a guide to help you navigate these areas that you may not have familiarity with. Something like, you know, you want a house built, but you don't know exactly how to do it, but you'd like a room over here and the fireplace and the living room and so on, and the carpenter would know exactly how to implement your dreams.
Peter, that's where fee-based practices that perhaps charge the client by the hour is a very valuable service.
I agree. I think for $100, $200 an hour to be able to sit down with someone occasionally and kind of get a reality check or ask those questions that are burning questions, get a few tools, a few insights, it pays back many, many times over.
Well, I think it was one of your fellow Americans that said, I think it was Donald Trump who said, you know, sometimes the best investments are the ones that you don't make. Mm-hmm. And I think as financial planners, perhaps our role is to keep clients away from these hot stocks that we touched upon earlier on. And we can do a great service to our clients by educating them, but also just giving them a steer in the right direction. I think that's crucially important.
Well, Duncan, I appreciate the perspective you brought and some of the differences between the U.S. and the U.K. and some of the issues that we all deal with just being consumers and human beings and dealing with money. Maybe you could give us a couple of examples where you and clients have gone a little deeper and discovered some things that were useful to the clients.
What I can say, Peter, is this recognition that by listening to the client often can come to their own conclusions. They have perhaps been confused by the amount of jargon that's thrown at them, but very often, you know, people are pretty smart, and they have a gut feeling, I often think, to what's right and what's wrong. So I think just by listening, an example would be perhaps where creating the time for clients to come with questions, if it's a new client, just having that list of questions, those perhaps silly questions, or which feel like silly questions but are often very important questions, and finding a financial planner that has the time to listen. I think in our previous conversation, Peter, you mentioned about if a financial planner has an educational edge to him or her, you know, if they're willing to explain jargon, explain things, you know, cut through the noise, then they're probably going to be good financial planners. So that would be my advice to the listeners, to find someone who truly listens and has the time to listen. But I do know from speaking to other financial planners, they themselves get so much in return from just perhaps having an hourly meeting with someone they haven't met before, and perhaps it won't lead to a long-term relationship, but the ability to give people a steer. Now, if you as the listener are paying your financial planner on an hourly basis, then as I said earlier, there is no hidden agenda. Little things that people perhaps struggle with is, you know, do I pay off my personal loan? Do I pay off my credit card bill? Do I pay off my mortgage? Or do I invest? And in the UK, we have there's a big sort of blind spot when it comes to that. And it's because historically banks have not wanted consumers to pay off debt. They've wanted them to invest in some commission-laden product that the bank or financial institution make money from. So we've now got a culture where people think debt is good. And as long as we find the next hot investment, then everything will end up rosy in the garden. So getting proper advice would be that on most occasions, paying off the debt would be a very smart move, or taking steps to reduce debt would be a very smart move, particularly as we're seeing interest rates globally starting to edge up. So again, paying for a financial planner's time, someone who listens, someone who will give you straight answers without an agenda is, I think, all part of the communication process. I know one financial planner was telling me just the other week that a particular client, a very wealthy lady, had come along to see him. She had she later on explained that she had been to see six different private banks and institutions, and she was really struck that she then realized that none of those organizations had listened to her at all. She almost felt that they knew what they were going to say to her before she walked in the door. So I think just getting back to basics, I would say to listeners and to consumers, try to break through the noise, go with your gut instinct, find someone who listens, and pay them that fee, because it will be the best decision you've ever made.
Well, I don't think I can say anything to add to that. That's wonderful. Duncan, really appreciate you taking the time to spend with us today and talk to us.
It's a pleasure, Peter. Thank you.
Well, thanks Peter and Duncan. As I said, Duncan has a very cool accent, but more importantly, he's a very educated and ethical planner. I hope our listeners found this interview interesting. Obviously, you can get more information on Duncan in the show notes at our website, promoneytalk.com. While you're at Pro Money Talk, make sure to sign up for our mailing list. We'll send you alerts for all new shows and from time to time send you a special gift, maybe. If you have any questions, comments, or feedback, love to hear from you. You can go ahead and email us. You can also give us a call. You can give us a call at area code 206-250-3428. And again, if you'll leave questions, we will answer them on the air. Perhaps even have an expert in the particular subject that you're inquiring about answer it on the air. And we're always looking for show ideas and interested in getting feedback from our listeners so that we can make the show better. As I mentioned at the beginning of the show, Peter is off at a conference this week. He's at the Financial Planning Association conference in Tennessee, which is our national conference. It's actually a wonderful conference. There are people from all over the world who come and attend. I'm a little disappointed that I wasn't able to go this year, but I will probably return again next year. If you'd like to reach Duncan, you can email him at inquiries@wealthflow.org. Now that is E-N-Q-U-I-R-I-E-S, ampersand wealthflow, W-E-A-L-T-H-F-L-O-W, .org, and Duncan will be happy to answer any questions that you have. Once again, we'd like to thank you for listening to the show. And until next episode, here's to your success.